dear listener, welcome back to Compilator. Before we dive into today's episode, I'd like to tell a short story. In the summer of 2002, the dot-com bubble had just burst and the future looked grim. Through an unlikely chain of events, a 19-year-old me finds himself in a cramped room waiting to interview a member of the British heavy metal band Iron Maiden on behalf of the Royal Institute of Technology's College Radio. As I'm sitting there, nervous, the door suddenly opens and the band member is ushered in by a swarm of assistants. He takes one look at this starstruck 19-year-old sitting there, mouth agape, and turns to the swarm of assistants with a gaze that says, "Are you kidding me?" With a sigh, he plops down on a chair in front of me and says, "Okay, kid, let's do this." He then proceeds to blow through my meticulously prepared questions in 3 of my allotted 20 minutes. As I'm sitting there in the most agonizing, awkward silence I have ever experienced, I vow to never again interview people I admire, and definitely not in English. Well, it turns out I'm a slow learner, because here I am today with Carl Franklin and Richard Campbell of .NET Rocks fame. Welcome, gentlemen.
Happy Hi. To be here.
That story reminds me of the time I interviewed Alan Cooper.
Oh, my goodness.
I was just like, blah, blah, blah,
blah, blah. Yeah, the father of Visual Basic.
Right. We always wondered who was the mother, though. Maybe it was Bill Gates.
Yeah, I think it's Windows, actually.
Windows was the mother.
It's funny that you mention Alan Cooper, because I was talking to my wife and I told her I'm a little bit nervous because I'm going to meet some of my idols. Mm. And she said, "What do you mean? You know, work idols, you don't have those?" And she's a chemical engineer. And she's like, "I cannot mention one person outside of my job." Mm. How come that?
Wouldn't she like to meet Bosch? You know, the man who basically invented industrial chemistry,
or the penicillin guy, or
yeah.
Well, the thing basically, is that they are dead. They are dead.
It's also details. Innovations happen a lot faster in our world than they did in the, you know, the vast spectrum of chemical engineering history. Yeah. I think,
but I mean, there has to be, like in development, a pantheon of, that's a $10 word, pantheon of. Exceptional people who both developers but also speakers and presenters and advocates. Why is it that our field has so many of those?
I think it's because they're mature. You know, mature industries change more slowly, and there's not a ton of innovation. Innovation happens really slowly. Right now, in this, while we're still not the engineering discipline we should be. Yeah, there's a bunch of personalities that are shaping the industry, and so we have this sort of, you know, effect.
Yeah, and innovation is going to continue to happen quickly, right? I mean, it's just the nature of tech. It just builds and builds and builds on itself.
Yeah, for a while. I think it's going to slow down. Like, I think we're, you know, Moore's Law ends this decade, right? Like, we run out of atoms. We're not going to get much smaller. Mm. And we're going to have to innovate in a different way. And mm-hmm. It's just sort of the... You know, once we sort of figured concrete out, innovation in certain classes of civil engineering slowed down. So I just wonder if we're not maturing finally.
It feels like that's been a topic debated since like the 70s. When is software development become a real engineering discipline?
Grow up.
Yeah. because we throw everything out. Like every 10 years and start anew. And
that's right.
Well, we keep getting new capabilities, right? So, yeah. I mean, part of this is that the platforms we're working on have kept evolving. The cloud, you know, computing becoming a utility is a sort of stabilizing force.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And as part of what I started thinking, you know, we're at only the beginning of that. You know, you compare that to the evolution of electricity in the end of the 19th century. And then fast forward 100 years, like electricity is not sexy. It's just a thing you use. And compute's going to become that way. It's just going to take a while.
Well, but the innovation's still going to happen in the cloud. I mean, the AI stuff is going to get better. The quantum computing is coming. You know, there are a lot of innovations that are coming. But I agree with Richard in that, you know, the first 10 years of .NET was just like a whirlwind. And some things were great and they lasted. And other things were stopgap measures. You know, and they eventually went away.
There
remember how annoyed people were going from 1.1 to 2.0 where a bunch of stuff broke?
Yeah.
There were folks who were like, well, I'm just going to stay with 1.1.
Yeah. Right? And the web forms not being in core.
Yeah. It's a much later generation frustration. So but that rate, has slowed down for
The whole thing with VB.net, right? I mean, that's
all part of it.
Yeah.
That's actually what I wanted to talk to you guys, because you host a show that's called .NET Rocks, mm-hmm. and as the name gives it away, you talk mostly to .NET people,
developers.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the longest running consecutive anything. I mean, The Simpsons only did 1,100 episodes so far, and you're up to 1,600 and
almost 1,700 now. Yeah,
1,677 somewhere along there.
Yeah. That's we people were asking us during the whole Windows 8 thing.
Yeah.
Are you now going to change the name of .NET Rocks? Oh, it started with WinFS and
Oh right, at PDC.
At PDC, the whole Longhorn thing.
Right.
So are you going to
Longhorn Rocks?
Are you going to call it Longhorn Rocks? And it's like we should have just called the show Two Brilliant Guys Who Can See the Future.
Which is not true at all.
Not true at all. Yeah. We can't predict the future. So we always said, and I always said from the first day I made the show, was we wanted to be for .NET developers wherever those interests take them.
Yeah.
Obviously, it took them down the JavaScript path, right?
Because for a while there. But admittedly, and I tell this story now once in a while, we walked out of Build in 2011.
Yeah.
Having just been to the new developers conference from Microsoft, where they basically didn't talk about .NET.
At all.
And we're like, and I'm looking at you like, what if .NET doesn't rock anymore?
Yeah, right.
So we made another show. We made the tablet show.
Still kept doing .NET rocks, because obviously we have a lot of listeners.
Well, and it was, it's not like .NET evaporates abruptly either.
Right.
But we had this content problem, because there were .NET developers that were trying to figure out how to do iOS and Android development.
Yeah.
And it was hard to do that inside the .NET context. We weren't sure what that was going to look like yet. So just spinning off the other show. Plus, it was a good exercise.
It was a good exercise.
Light up the new site, new infrastructure, new promotion. Could we get people to sign up to the show? One of the downsides to be, I argue, this is my statement. Carl's never said this. I think he has the third RSS to feed in the world. Right, because you implemented the Dave Weiner drop that spec. You called me and said, Dave Weiner's got this thing, and I think it's brilliant. It's going to be huge. I'm writing it right now.
I basically wrote a feed.aspx.
Yeah.
From
the very, very beginning.
In VB.net, and I'm even still using it.
Do you remember when we were in Manchester and we found that somebody had built a test app for testing RSS, and it had been pinging the site every day?
Yeah.
Just constantly.
And we're like, look at all those downloads.
And then we get turned into it. It's like, this is all the same IP address. Yeah. And he's literally walking the whole RSS feed. Like, I think it's literally a piece of software someone wrote as a test a decade earlier.
Yeah.
And it had just been running every day. And we had to block the IP.
Yeah.
Like, it was defective. And but it's a side effect of being first.
Our listenership dramatically went down that day.
But,
we went from 5 to 4.
The tablet show was us starting from scratch, trying to see if we could build another show. But by 2014, it became, then I had the opposite problem, where I used to not know where to put iOS and Android, so that was why I didn't went into the tablet show.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do I know to not just put this in .NET Rocks? Because .NET and iOS and Android all work together, so we just rolled it back in.
Yeah.
So it was a good experiment.
We still have those shows out there, and if people are interested in the history, it's a great way to go through it.
Yeah, it's 140 episodes.
Yeah.
We'll link to them from the show notes,
for sure,
so people can take a look. But on the topic of maturing, I'd say that with .NET Core 5 that's coming out.
Or .NET 5, they call it. Yeah,
they're going to drop the core.
They dropped the core. Okay.
They will drop the core.
Okay.
Soon there will be a .NET.
Yeah.
Just one.
I'm looking forward to the stability, because the last 10 years have been, it's been a roller coaster. And not only with .NET, but in development in general. Like, first it was .NET, then Node was the hot thing, then JavaScript in general, and now .NET has made an amazing comeback, both technically, but as well as marketing-wise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also think you saw the transformation of Microsoft there, right? They've stopped being the Windows-centric company, started being the cloud-centric company.
The changes in the market certainly affected us. I mean, our we, for the longest time, enjoyed really good advertising revenue from advertisers that were selling high-priced ticket items, right? Then they could afford the advertising they wanted to get in there and be in a forum like .NET Rocks where people were paying attention. And it turns out podcasts are great for advertising because people actually listen. You know, they're, it's not just a graphic on a website that you can completely ignore. But, you know, when everything went web and most of the tools that the programmers who were listening to .NET Rocks were using, and probably because we wanted to stay on the cutting edge with topics, so we did a lot of JavaScript and Ruby and Node and all that stuff. Those tools are mostly open source and free. And so these companies had a harder time justifying, you know, with the limited sales that they had, the expense of advertising on a podcast like this. So yeah, it affected us financially quite a bit, and we had to scale back and scale down. And, you know, it remains to be seen what happens with Blazor, because there's a new, you know, this new component model that has opened up this third-party market again. But there's still going to be open source tools out there for Blazor. It's not like it takes a very specialized .NET developer to make a set of components for Blazor. It just takes time and effort, right? Whereas before, the Windows Forms controls, you know, the WPF controls, well, there was only like a handful of people I knew in the community that could even attempt to do that, right? Because of all the ceremony and it's all C++ and everything else. So it remains to be seen what happens. But yeah, it certainly did affect us.
Speaking of Blazor, tomorrow I'm having a show dropping with Jimmy Engström about Blazor.
Yeah.
And I went into that episode very skeptical. I was thinking that this is either going to be Silverlight or in the best case, it's going to be like web forms with real-time view state.
Well, if you think about why Silverlight became the laughingstock of development, it wasn't because it wasn't a good technology.
Oh no, I'm just afraid of getting burned.
Of course, but just because the technology output does something similar to Silverlight doesn't mean it has nothing to do with the reasons why Silverlight, you know, why you got burned, quote unquote. The reason that Silverlight doesn't really exist and isn't really usable now is because plugins are verboten in browsers. That's it. And you know, Apple had
the most popular
platform, rising platform of the day, which was iPads and iPhones, and everybody saw that revolution coming. And no plugins in the browser, Silverlight isn't going to work. What are we going to do here? You know, so that he killed it basically.
But I don't think that's why people are angry. I think people are angry because Microsoft didn't address it. I mean, literally never explained. They knew internally, and this is all part of the book, right? That Silverlight had a huge problem once iOS wasn't going to run it. They just didn't actually, you know, in April of 2010, that's when they shipped Studio 2010 and they promoted Silverlight 4 heavily.
Right.
And it was the enterprise platform. By November of 2010, that's the, you know, the famous interview with Mary Jo Foley and Bob Muglia where he says, our strategy has shifted.
Right.
Right. And that's really because that he realized internally that was going on. I don't know that he was the first person to have said anything to the public about that.
Well, and also they never actually stopped supporting it until after it was very clear that nobody was using it. But
it's still in long-term support.
Yeah, and the smart developers knew that it didn't have any legs just because the future of browsers changed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So
the Silverlight 5 falls out of support in 2021.
But it isn't really fair to Blazor to lump it in that basket because it has nothing to do with the technology that Silverlight was using, but it is trying to achieve the same result, which is I want to write C#, and I want it in the browser, and I want to have more of a desktop application look and feel. So the technology, WebAssembly, that makes Blazor client-side work is a standard that is supported, that's an open standard, and it's supported by all browsers. So it isn't going away, and one company like Apple can't just kill it.
And that's the takeaway of that episode that drops tomorrow, is that at the end of the show, I'm deeply enthusiastic about Blazor. Yeah. I mean, I've not looked forward to play with a certain technology for a long time like I have with Blazor.
I got into it. I'm still getting into it. And I've never been more productive building web applications including web forms, than I am with Blazor. Just ridiculously productive.
And it's still really young. We're still seeing
really young.
Substantial changes coming from Sanderson and Co. I mean, they're still figuring out exactly what they want, even on the server side, much less the client side, which is essentially unshipped.
But here's the thing. C# is C#, right? So it's not what you can do with Blazor that's going to change. It's the internals of how things are handled, how debugging works, the efficiency of stuff going over SignalR, using gRPC, like all of these things are coming.
And we never have to write npm install again.
I'd be so happy if I never have to write another frickin' line of JavaScript. But I probably still will, if I need to, only.
I actually went really deep into JavaScript, and I really liked it for a while, until I had to come back to a project that I left a year and a half. And I had to rewrite it because
you're looking at it, it's like, what idiot wrote
this? Aside from that, no packages were working anymore, basically.
Oh, right. All the libraries you depended on only 18 months ago were now basically out of maintenance or had been changed enough that you had to.
And I cannot for the life of me understand why there's such a difference between NPM and NuGet, because they're both package handlers, but package management handlers, but I don't know. There's something about the psychology of, I don't know, .NET and JavaScript, or where that discrepancy in stability comes from.
Sure. Well, I think NuGet's origins at Microsoft with this strong philosophy of long-term backward compatibility.
I think Visual Studio.
Yeah, you see that reflected in NuGet, too. And it doesn't have to be. It's literally a cultural phenomenon.
So I remember this. Do you remember the panel that we did in Nashville?
Is
software development too complex?
Yeah, and it's like in the 400s.
So this is about the time when Silverlight was, you know, in
shipping out of band.
It was like two or three. And out of band is the key. In order to get the latest bits, you had to go read Scott Guthrie's blog where he would announce the next version and stuff. But now if you're searching the blog sphere for these things, the problem is unless these blog posts were dated and, you know, deprecated, right? You may end up going down a rabbit hole of some old technology that doesn't even exist anymore. So it was really ridiculously frustrating. And I remember saying at that time in that show, what I really want is like an RSS feed that has the latest builds of these out-of-band things and the latest packages and all that stuff. And I didn't know, but I was describing what would become NuGet. That's what I wanted. I wanted a feed. I didn't want to have to go hunt for something on the web and use Google.
They were already building it. That was, you know, what was really cool about that panel, and I talk about this occasionally with folks, I mean, it's like there's panels and there's panels, right?
Yeah.
And we work pretty hard on, I need three or four people who are familiar with a given subject material and also disagree, like have different positions on it, but then also have similar temperaments. Like you don't need a really bombastic person.
I know where you're going.
Some quieter people. You can go poke through the panel, stack of panels we've done over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
But what was cool about the Nashville show was we lost control of it.
Yeah.
Like about half, we had some pretty, Billy Hollis was on that panel, right? There were some pretty sturdy personalities on the panel. There were some pretty sturdy personalities in the audience.
In the audience. Like
we had
Buddha.
Floor mics. You yes, that? Yeah, right. He was there.
He was mad.
Yeah.
He was angry.
But, I mean, from a hosting perspective, as someone making shows, like, we were also delighted. Like, when the show starts making itself, like, there's a debate going on, like, we're getting to the essence of a of the conversation of this topic. That was a good day.
It was a great show.
We actually print CDs of that show and started distributing them because it was one of those shows just had a lot of legs.
Right. And that was in the time when people knew what CDs were and used them regularly.
Well, and that the internet.
What is this disc that I don't understand?
What is this thing? Like, where does this go? How does this fit in my USB drive?
I'm a musician,
drive?
And I hand the CDs to people. They're like, what do I do? This represents work. I got to find somebody with a burner and turn it into MP3 right. So I can actually listen to it.
But at that time, MP3s and internet was an impediment.
Yeah, it was.
And so an audio CD was actually more consumable.
We used to ship audio CDs to people.
Yeah.
They used to sign up for them.
We used to provide, and the show used to be provided in a format specifically designed to be burned to CD.
Huh. Yeah.
Because people, you know, they,
if we had,
dude started in 2002. Like, he predates the iPod.
If we had more than 80 minutes in a show, we had to do two CDs. Yeah. You know?
Then it became an expensive show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things got a lot easier over the years.
Yeah. One format.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We used to do
AAC.
What's the matter with us?
Now, well, because it wasn't. Do you remember there was a serious concern that MP3 would be locked down, that Fraunhofer was going to actually take it out of the domain? Like, you would have to pay a license fee to produce an MP3. Like, you were hedging your bets.
Yeah.
This is all you, man, not me. I just worried about content. You fought all those fights. Like, yeah. We dealt with all of that stuff.
That's true. BitTorrent.
Well, and yeah, BitTorrent. And also, remember the big showdown over podcasts? And there was going to be, we actually met Mark Maron in Vancouver
had
a conversation about him when there was going to be a lawsuit about, you know, whether or not
taxes or something.
Yeah,
or?
Podcasting at whole was going to have a licensing model.
Right, right.
And here we were, one of the oldest podcasts on the planet. So, you know, if they were going to go after anybody, we were vulnerable.
And I remember having a few conversations with Mark about that.
Yeah.
And he was really concerned.
Well, sure. The guy made his career off the back of that. And you
still
know,
going strong, too.
Still going strong.
WTF. No,
all of that went away. Here we are, still doing the thing.
Here we are.
So you started the podcast before the iPod existed.
August 2002.
Yeah, the word podcast shows up in 2005.
So, yeah, I just called an internet talk show for .NET developers, but our audio talk show, So there were a couple of players out there. There was the Rio player, if I remember, Creative Labs, Rio.
But that was MP3, not podcasting. MP3 player. Right?
Yeah, so people would download the MP3 and then they'd have to copy them to their... There was the Zune, which was in the response to the iPod.
Yeah, it's post.
But before the iPod, there was that Rio player, and then there was a couple other players, too.
Yeah, there was a couple of Korean ones, and there was a Rio player. Rio actually made it physical.
Right.
And then the iPod swallowed that.
Rio player had, like, it was a little triangular thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was some weird format. I mean, it was experimental time. I bought the Diamond Rio the day the Supreme Court said you were allowed to. The RIA didn't want MP3 out there. They wanted again licensing fees and so forth. And so
little did they know.
Yeah. So when the Diamond, like, the funny part is, you think back and go, they weren't wrong.
No, they weren't.
Right.
But they weren't going to contain it either.
Yeah. And so, but the day that it came down that the Rio was allowed to be sold, I immediately ordered one.
Yeah.
And it held a whole 16 megs of recording, like dun dun dun. But, so you know, that thing got me into more airplane cockpits. Like, pilots love gadgets.
Yeah.
Back before 9/11, if you had a cool gadget, like, the pilot wanted to see it. So it became, I had a mission to get jump seat landings, right? To be able to sit in the jump seat when the planes landed. And so that was a gadget the pilot liked enough. And then if you're not an idiot and you're reasonably, you know, pleasant to be around, like, it's a boring job.
Did you actually get to sit in a jump seat?
I've done a bunch of jump seat landings.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. But then, of course, 9/11 ended all of that.
Yeah,
but in those,
that's right.
You know, in the 90s, during the .com boom, when I was zipping around fixing people's websites, I was, you know.
That's pretty cool,
Leverage those technical gizmos.
I never heard that story, but I did hear the story about how you aced the air traffic controller exam and then said, yeah, I don't want to be a civil servant.
Yeah.
Turns out who does that?
Yeah, no.
First of all.
I'm pretty good at 3D math. That's what I know.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Weird stories.
Anyway, what were we talking about? Podcasting 2002? Yeah. Downloading. Yeah, I just started this thing because I loved NPR, National Public Radio in the United States. And on Saturdays, they would have these edutainment programs that would be like car talk or, you know, quiz shows or stuff like this. And they were fun to listen to, but they were also very informative. And that's the kind of format that I wanted, although we experimented a little too much with the fun stuff side of it. And
back in the day,
we had to split off the fun into another.
I remember
podcast.
Having that conversation with you, right?
Yeah.
It was, so we met in 2004.
Yeah.
And I was a guest during the reign of the second co-host. So mm-hmm. Rory was the co-host then.
Yeah.
And it was almost 2.5, maybe a 3-hour show. And it was a variety show.
Right.
There was some comedy and some music. And there
shows
was,
50 to 100 yeah, were 2 hours.
Technical interviews.
Two interviews, and we had jokes and music.
All kinds of things, right?
We tried to do that.
And so I remember in the fall of 2004, I'm like, look, there's a Venn diagram here.
Yeah.
Right? In one circle, you've got folks that like technical interviews. Right. There's lots of those.
Yeah.
And then you have another circle where it's folks who like humorous stuff on the internet.
And they're all .NET developers, yeah. Right?
The intersection between those is small. There's only a few people who want both.
That's right.
What if we just sort of pull the circles apart and we'll make two shows, right? We'll do the interview on one side and we'll do the fun stuff on another side. And we did.
Yeah, we did. The fun show was called Mondays.
Yeah.
I say was, but we may ride again.
We may make another one.
We may make another one, yeah.
The thing that's amazing about Mondays is that for at least a year, we made one every week.
Right.
And that's comedy. We did
it was
comedy
hard.
Every week for a year.
That's back when I was a dilettante and I could afford the time to edit
well,
8 hours
yeah.
of editing a week.
Yeah, because only you could edit those shows. And
right.
You did a great job. Like, there's a lot of subtlety to the editing of a comedy show versus...
A lot of the humor is in the timing.
Totally.
And, you know, you had to make that right in the edit. And somebody who was just coming in to edit just couldn't do it.
The .NET Rocks edit is still not trivial, but it's straightforward.
Yeah.
It is an interview.
Yeah.
The Mondays edit was a lot more complex, but
right.
Yeah, no, we had time, and it was still novel too.
Right.
But Mondays evolved into four friends trying to make each other laugh,
and it still makes me crack up every time I listen to it.
Some of the funniest moments of our lives are on. Like, there's a few shows where what you don't know is we literally had to stop recording. We were crying. It's like, we might as well stop. This is going to take a while. It's generally the shows where by the end of it, I'm really quite drunk.
Right.
That's a very long recording. Because I drink steadily through Mondays, and I go last. So if you ever hear a Mondays where it's like, holy man, that dude is drunk, we probably stopped a couple of them.
So every Christmas when we did Mondays, Richard, his bit at the end is called Richard the Toy Boy, where he finds the weird, the wild, the wonderful, weirdy, crazy things people are selling on the internet. All right. So, and he would come up with these good toys and bad toys. And so the Christmas episode was always great because he would find toys that each of us would like. Now I say like in quotes because...
But like and or horrified.
Or, yeah, exactly. So one year, he's completely ripped. He's in the, like half a bottle of bourbon.
It's 2 hours in or something, right? Like it's been a really long session.
I'll do what he said. He goes, go ahead, Richard. What do you got? You know, every year we do this stupid show. And every Christmas.
And you can hear them going, oh, no.
And every Christmas, I pick a present for you, Carl, and you, Mark, and you, Karen. But this year, I'm going to pick toys for me, because f*** you guys.
Just destroyed us. Just
You're like the drunk uncle at Christmas sitting under the tree.
Take your fucking presents.
I don't care. Give me another brandy.
Yep. That was me.
Oh, man. Yeah. Too much fun.
At least the serious show, so to speak. Not that we're all that serious. I think one of the claims to fame for us, we've always been very lighthearted about what we do.
We don't take ourselves too seriously.
And how much fun being in technology actually is.
Yeah. Right?
Like, it's really a delight. And so that I hope that comes across in the show. It's like, come on. You're going to love this. It's amazing. like, come with us. We're going to have some fun.
Right.
That's one of the things that I really liked about the show, because it's been following me basically as long as I've been getting paid to write code.
Mm-hmm.
it's well, the diversity of the people that you have on, it's not like just hardcore .NET developers. Right. You have all sorts of people.
Yeah.
It reflects the industry too, and it's changing as well.
Oh yeah,
definitely. I mean, it's been a few years now, but we're starting. We do have more the bucket list experience. So it's folks that started listening to the show literally at the beginning of their career, and maybe said to themselves early on, "It's like someday I want to be on that show," and then they do, which is fine. Like yeah. everything's good about that, but it's a rush for us too,
right? Sure.
You sort of have this moment where it's like, you know, at the end of it, somebody says, literally, well, there, check it off, something from my bucket list. Someday I want to be on .NET Rocks, and now it's done.
And there's one thing also that may be a limiting factor in how many people actually listen to the show, is that we do have a topic for every show, which is sort of the main theme, but it is by no means everything that we talk about. Like, it's a very tangential show. Like, we just have a conversation. And sometimes the title that we start with that is based on what the guest has given us, you know, our theme is going to be, sometimes we change it.
It goes off the rails, yeah.
Because that turns out to be a very small portion of what we actually talk about.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I like is if I wanted to have a deep dive about something, I could go watch a video. It's the tangents that are interesting, and plus the fact that you guys are really good interviewers and you get a lot of interesting stuff out of people.
Right. We've never held back on the opportunity for people to destroy their careers on the show.
That's true.
You know, mostly with Microsoft people. It's like, yeah. You know, if you want to go off the rails, we're willing to let you go. It's fine.
Here's some rope.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just keep going. That's good.
Good for ratings.
But also, we're very trusted, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the product teams have, on a routine basis, almost every year, some team comes and does an interview with us about a product that isn't released yet. Because they know they're only going to get, you know, 5 minutes worth of demo at a build keynote. And then they can have an hour with us. And on many occasions, we have literally sat there, like hand over the button, the moment the build announces needs to publish. Yep. So, I would argue one of the most famous examples of that. Well, the announcement of Silverlight's a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
But also the acquisition of Xamarin.
Yep, acquisition of Xamarin. We were actually in the audience, and I had my finger on the publish button.
But we were allowed to interview Miguel and Nat 2 weeks ahead of that. And that's actually SEC stuff. Like, that's a big deal to leak anything about an acquisition in advance. And so we had that interview in the can with permission from the senior folks at Microsoft.
And we've done it with Guthrie and Hunter and we were many times.
Yeah, product announcement's one thing. The acquisition was kind of another. But
yeah, big one.
We could not do anything until it was officially announced on the stage, and then we released the show. We've also had, with product announcements, we've had them call us and go, hey, we're not going to announce that. Can you not publish that? And they're like, okay, yeah, we have a backup show. That's not a problem. It's like, well, it's going to be announced later. You can release that show later on. But that's the price of playing that game is sometimes the product doesn't always come out.
Right.
So you have a vault of interviews that you've done that you cannot use.
There's a few. The one that I'm thinking of was, remember that when we did the weekend of .NET where we recorded like 12 hours a day, 3 days in a row.
Yeah, it turns out some of those weren't so good.
Well, especially the end, you kind of could tell when it got towards the end of the day on 10, 11 hours.
And people are calling in like, hey, how's it going? Like, this is supposed to be a show, right?
Yeah, but the specific show I'm thinking of is Chris Sells.
Yeah,
about Oslo. And I went off on him, if you recall.
First of all, Oslo...
Not
a lot
the city.
Of people might not know what this was, but it was like a DSL for data.
Mm. Yeah. It had a lot of interesting ideas in it.
And Don Box and Chris Sells were both working on it.
Yep, at the time.
So they came on the show. They had come on the show like a year before, right?
Well, they'd come on several times. Right, and that was the whole thing I went after Chris on at that. You know, it was late enough in the day. We're a little snarky. And I'm like, listen, man, you've been talking to us about, you know, how great Oslo is going to be for like 3 years. Like, where... Is it?
Yeah. What the hell's going on over there?
You know, the reality is when you're building a new technology, like if it's going to ship, it'll ship the first 2 years. You know, every month after the second year, probability of shipping is going down. And we're well into the third year. Like, what's going on?
But it turned out the only people that really cared about it were Chris and Don.
Yeah. Well, so. I, we were, we were intense enough on Chris that at the end of the show, and he's a friend, like, make no bones, like,
yeah,
there's guests we've had on the show, oh, yeah, that people we know. So
they're both
Chris
good
Sells
friends.
Is genuinely a friend.
Yeah.
He's been to my house. I've been to his house. Like, yep, that. And he said, you better let me know when you're going to publish that because I'm going to have to tell PR. And I felt a little bad. Just a little. I mean, yeah, I didn't say anything I didn't truly believe.
But you were like, what the hell are you guys doing?
Because yeah, I think that's exactly what the audience is thinking. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
In between the time we recorded that show and when it was going to be published, also got canceled.
Yep.
And it's just like, now it's just mean.
Yeah. We couldn't release
it. Yeah. Just, I don't know if the files even exist.
Right.
But it's, it doesn't matter. It's just mean now. It was, you know, and I don't know that he knew and helped. I probably didn't, but it got shut down. And so it's just like, it's a worthless show.
There were only a handful of shows that we ever had to not publish.
Yeah. We've had.
There's been a couple that we lost.
Yeah.
Just.
Technical, you know, problems.
Technical problems. But yeah, but also, I remember one. I remember doing an interview with a guy, and it was supposed to be about ASP.NET, and it was right after 9/11. And he came on, and he was just like, I don't know, man. I don't know what's going on with the world, man. Like, I spent some time in Turkey, and I'm going over there, and I'm just seeing what people are doing. They're just walking the streets. Like, it's all like this political, social thing, right?
Which 30 seconds of is fine.
Well, I gave him a good 10 minutes. You
That's
know, and
too
I'm
much,
like,
yeah,
okay, hey, do you have anything to say about ASP.NET? And he was like, no, man, I'm sorry. I got nothing. And I'm like, all right, well, you know, this isn't a show. So
yeah,
we have to cut it. But understandable, just not the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember we had an interview with a guy who was just patently wrong. Like, and I'm Googling what he's saying and like double checking. And it's like, that's not correct. Do you want to correct that? And,
right,
you know, and you try and hint them into the right direction first as the recording.
Yeah.
So it's natural. And then finally, I'm like, edit point. Listen, I've looked it up here, and what you're saying is incorrect. And he yelled at me about it. It's like, you know, he's trying to defend his position. So I was, yeah, like, this isn't a debate.
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking at the facts as they're written by the company that made the product. What you're saying is incorrect.
Yeah.
Anyway, oddly enough, didn't publish that show.
Richard, you're writing a book about the history of .NET.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Yeah. You lived it.
Yeah, that helps, but it's also a hindrance too, right?
Mm.
The inspiration came from a party. I was in 2017, threw a party for the 15th anniversary of the launch of .NET in Redmond, and I was invited to come down and help out. One of the things I did, and you can find this on Channel 9, was I did these little 5-minute sort of happy birthday .NET vignettes with various luminaries, especially from the early days of .NET. And in some ways, I think I felt like I remembered their stories better than they did. You know, I think the hard part about being an engineer is you make a lot of things, and many of them don't ever see the light of day. Like, I think it's the part that most people don't understand, especially when you talk about a company like Microsoft, where they're always experimenting. They write a lot of code and play with it for a while. And maybe they ship it out to the public when they don't. The amount of you think about how many betas we've ever seen in it,
right,
community previews and things that don't become products, we see there's at least that much again that never makes it out of the office.
So it's kind of a filter of what's historically significant and what isn't. They don't always have those at the
Well, they have no way of knowing that.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and in some ways, you know, you talk to a guy like a Patrick Desaad, like one of the guys who worked on the early CLR, and the product quickly moved away from him, too. Like, he built some foundational stuff. He was part of the battle that decided between garbage collection and reference counting.
Mm.
But he didn't, he you know, pieces of that code then went to other teams. So he almost didn't know what happened to it, right? Most of the engineers are focused on their particular piece. They're one of hundreds, maybe even thousands of developers. And they rarely get to see the interplay between them all.
Mm.
And so I came out of that experience thinking, you know, hey, everybody's getting a little older. And this is a long time ago now. And if we don't write it down soon, like, we're just not going to know.
Yeah.
But I get weird ideas all the time. Like, that's not that unusual. And the good news is I tend to write them down. And then I decided to test it. So a month or two later, I just sat down and wrote out everything I thought I knew, pulled up easy research sources and said, could you make a talk? I started with like a 1-hour history of .NET, what do you think, and tested it at some local user groups and got really interesting reactions.
Hmm.
And that sort of got me thinking, you know, just trying to figure out, like, is there a thing here? Like, what does this thing really look like?
Hmm.
And then finally, when I got, I was convinced, okay, there's enough folks that are interested. It's not just like the old .NET people, but other folks are want to know more about what's going on. I decided, well, okay, you know, I'm doing the engineers thing. Find me a reason not to do this.
Right.
And the next step for me was, who do you have to have in the book? And if you don't have them, it's not credible. And so it was Anders Hallsberg.
Yeah.
You kind of have to have Anders.
Sure.
Scott Guthrie.
Yep.
Brian Harry.
Yeah.
And he immediately looped in Jason Zander. Now this is where the whole .NET Rocks thing comes in huge. Because I've got those email addresses. I've had those people on the show. And they will take my call.
Yep.
And so I wrote emails to all of them and said, I'm thinking about doing a book. And here's, you know, sort of the idea I have. You know, would you participate? And within a day, actually, Goo got back to me first.
Yeah.
And Goo did it his typical way, which was to refer to his manager of schedules.
Right.
Make sure Richard gets time on my schedule. Because he is a busy man.
Yes.
But there's no higher compliment in my mind than when Scott says, make sure we make time for Richard. I want this. But even Brian Harry, who's remarkably reticent, came back and said, absolutely, and let me know what time you need to have. Right. Anders actually the hardest one to reach.
Yeah.
Just hard to reach because the way he works and what he's doing. In the end, I didn't get a solid yes out of him until I went to campus and Mads Torgensen walked me to his office.
Yeah.
And I came in. And, of course, he remembers me. I mean, we've had dinner and things together, done a bunch of shows. I'm like, listen, this is what I want to do. He goes, I love it. Shall we start now? I'm like, wait. And Miguel Diaz-Caza was like that, too. Right. I really met him, and I said, listen, I'm thinking about doing this. And Miguel's a demonstrative guy. He gave me a big hug. He's like, oh, my God, that's such a good idea. I've
got 60 minutes right now.
And then he pushes me back. He sort of looks at me and goes, and I'm so glad it's you. You are the right person. I have notes. You need my notes. And I went to Boston with him to see him. And Joseph, who's worked with him for forever and is generally his adult supervision, kind of came to me and says, you're going to let me see what you're talking about. I'm like, no, Joe, I'm not.
So you've now collected all these interviews and you started writing it, but are there going to be bombshells?
And there are things I know that I'm still trying to figure out how to write about.
Well, and do you have permission to write about?
Well, that's an interesting point. Everybody knows they're on the record. Mm-hmm. Everything is actually recorded, but also at a very high level of trust. The number of times my friends have said, think carefully about how you're going to talk about this, but I want you to know this.
Right, right.
And so part of this is also recognizing that I'm asking people to remember things that happened a decade or two ago.
Yeah.
And so I've been getting multiple versions of the same meeting, all different. And so I'm not going to tell any one person's version. I have to build composites. And in that point of view, it's my fault, right? I'm trying to construct a version of the truth about things that happened quite a while ago and under various, you know, levels of contention.
And you can also come to conclusions on your own from these various things that, but individually they may not have together.
You know, Mads Torgensen wasn't aware of what the CLR team did between 1.1 and 2.0 that made the CLR dramatically better because it wasn't his job.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's those kinds of things where he's like,
That's where they put it in SQL Server, right?
They put it,
running. And the SQL team really made it rigorous SQL tests.
They build enterprise class software that is heavily tested, and they had really great test harnesses. And part of the motivation of the CLR team to build SQL CLR, which is a questionable idea, right? Running .NET inside a SQL Server.
We were concerned at the time. It's like, why would I do that?
Well, and it's off by default. Take the hint.
Yeah.
Right. To this day, it's off by default. Although they now.
But the answer is, you know, if there are things that you want to do in a stored procedure that you can only do with code, you do them as an extended stored procedure.
Yeah. It's a super extended stored procedure. But most of the cases that they had in 2005 when they were doing this are better solved by reactive extensions. Right. Mm. But that stuff didn't exist back then. This was an earlier solution to that space. But it's that composing of all these different pushes, the number of different people I've spoken to now who were pro open source when it was not appropriate at Microsoft in the early aughts. And so they feel like they were sort of original champions.
Phil Hack, Scott Hanselman, Rob Connery.
Although those all fall into Guthrie's push of that. But there were other teams, right? There were other spots where open source became apparently important.
Yeah.
And so part of my challenge in telling the story as a whole is sort of to give respect to the fact that there was a gestalt, there was an asymmetrical rebellion going on inside of Microsoft to make open source part of the equation.
But they weren't organized as such.
They were not. There wasn't a plan. It was an emergence. In that sense. The same way the .NET was not a plan. Like .NET is a found product. They were folks dealing with runtime problems. We weren't allowed to work in Java anymore.
How much time have we got? Because I want to go get a bottle of wine. just saying, like, this is usually when we pop the scotch.
But you get the idea that it's like, it is this composite view. It's also taking me a non-trivial amount of time.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm still enjoying myself, so clearly I haven't worked on it enough. Like, it has to become that damn book before it'll really be close to done. But there's moments. But there's a lot to tell. And, it is interesting to talk about what really happened to Silverlight, because I have very good versions of all of them.
Yep.
And what really happened during Windows 8, and what happened to Azure and how it became the thing, and what actually turned the switch to become that open source started to play a major role inside of Microsoft.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many stories.
Did you get to talk to Uncle Satya?
I have not talked to Uncle Satya.
Are you going to?
I would like to. Soma Sagar, who ran DevDiv in the aughts and in the late aughts, early teens, has told me I really need to talk to Bill. And he's been advocating to Bill's people to make time for me, which hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
I have a good list of questions. Like, there's certain particular
things. He doesn't ever really talk about developer stuff.
Anymore. Not at all.
Yeah.
And yet still, he's like at 20% time at Microsoft.
Right.
It was part of the conditions of Satya becoming CEO, is that Bill would come back.
Mm.
But not as the face of it, but rather as somebody who reviews the product teams and puts pressure on them to be as good as they can be and sort of sort certain key senior technical problems, right? When you've got teams that are competing. You know, the biggest thing I see Gates do today that I hear over and over again in my interactions with the team is that he deconflicts products. So if three different teams are actually building the same thing, it's Bill that says, you're all building the same thing, you should all contribute members to a sub-team, and then each of you consume it, that thing, whatever that may be. Mm. You know, we think about Project Rome. You remember Project Rome? It showed up in, like, Build in 2016 or so. And that was one of those things where there was a bunch of different teams working on identity problems.
Mm.
And Bill sort of said, make a separate project. Mm. Everybody contribute to it. Everybody consume it. Don't repeat yourself, kind of thing. And I think that's his superpower, is A, he can sort all that stuff out. He can look at a couple of hundred products and see the similarities where they exist. And then has the gravity to say, thou shalt do it this way. And they do it.
Any interest in talking to Steve, developers, Ballmer?
I would love to.
Do you think he would have anything to contribute?
I don't know. He was there.
He was there.
Yeah, he was actually the CEO through, you know, he took over 2000 when .NET's just emerging. So,
right. He must have had directives and.
Yeah, I'd be interesting to sort of press on that. Hmm. The other person I did reach out to is Steven Sinofsky.
Oh, yeah.
Who politely declined.
Yeah.
But
he's got a bad taste in his mouth.
Well, I think you're not wrong. I also think that he was pretty point blank, but it's like, you know, I didn't really work with .NET.
No, he was a Windows guy.
Yeah, and that's the truth. And so I respect for that.
And, you know, it was respectful to make that last push effort to get people to buy more Windows. And that's what that was all about.
Well, and also to bet on JavaScript, especially when you think in the context of 2010, 2011, where JavaScript was absolutely ascendant and still is. Like, if you were really, here we are in, you know, .NET developer podcasters, but if you're truly starting Greenfield, you're going to train a new team on a new project, how do you not choose JavaScript?
No, it's true.
I mean, for all of its options available to you, and whether you want to go to mobile and whether you want to be in the cloud, like, it's a pretty versatile language. Now, you need, appropriate harnesses around it. How are you going to test it? How are you going to maintain it? How are you going to make sustainable software around it? All of which is challenging for JavaScript. It's got to be in consideration.
Yeah, well, Sinofsky did wonderful things in Windows 7. And Windows 10 contains a lot of that same code base.
Yeah.
But, that build, man, we were scared.
It was a tough day.
What did Stephen Forte call it? Sinofsky Con.
Yeah. it was, and there were people being fired for speaking out of turn. Like, it was, at a time, Microsoft had spent several years being very open
Right.
Which will also be, that's part of what went wrong with Vista, was they were almost too open. They were showing stuff that wasn't ready.
Yeah.
And here was a guy who wanted to work completely a different way. There's a case to be made. I'm not saying he was right. I'm actually pretty sure he was wrong.
He wanted to be more Apple-like. He wanted to wait until you can't see it till it's finished.
Yeah, right. But that's not how developers work. That's not how large corporations work with new technologies.
Right.
And it's not, Apple made a half a dozen products and Microsoft makes 300. Like, the model doesn't work. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So, Richard, I'm dying to read the book.
Yeah, me too.
I hope it comes out soon.
I hope so too.
We're slowly running out of time. And I would like to tie into a thing that you said. Why would you choose anything except JavaScript for a greenfield? And I would want to know from both of you, with all of this history that you have, where do you see .NET going? Is it going to be the new Java, which is the new COBOL, or
nice?
Is it?
You want to? What's to put it in a box?
Yeah. The only thing wrong with Java is that Oracle owns it, and so it hasn't been innovated on. Yeah. They're not giving it the resources it deserves to continue to evolve. And I mean, Java also has some fundamental problems that .NET doesn't have,
right?
Because .NET got to look at what was going wrong with Java in 2000 and 2001 and not make the same mistake.
And they also kept innovating,
Yeah.
And so Java didn't.
And it's kind of stuck. And I'm saying, you can't not consider JavaScript, but there's plenty of reasons not to choose JavaScript, too. And part of this has to do with the skill sets that are available to you. But it is very difficult to build large, sustainable applications in JavaScript.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's very challenging. And you put a lot of work into tools like TypeScript and things to try and make more maintainable code.
Yeah.
If you
frameworks.
Are talking about, I spent a lot of time as an enterprise architect and advising enterprise architects. And we're looking at software that's going to have decade plus lifespans. You've got to look at what tools, lend themselves to that strain.
There's certainly nobody is arguing that .NET on the server makes a lot of sense. .NET Core, ASP.NET Core running in a container on Linux, whatever, in your cloud, my cloud, your brother's sister's cloud. That's really, really powerful stuff. And the stuff they're doing in Azure adds to that. But the client side is where Microsoft has traditionally had the most change, upheaval, and consternation, right? Because .NET started out as a Windows technology. And it still kind of has that moniker of being tied to Windows, even though it's completely disassociated from Windows now. But, not a lot of people writing Windows apps anymore, new ones. Not a lot of people, relative to web apps, I'm saying. There's still a lot going on. WPF apps, just talk to Billy. He might be the only guy that builds WPF apps anymore, but he says business has gone up 500%.
He's bombing. Lately. He's booming.
He can't do it fast enough for WPF.
I'm going to make two arguments for you. First is there are remarkably good server-side technologies that are outside of the .NET space.
True.
Go, Rust, technologies like Cassandra and so forth, very large scale, highly efficient chunks of code. Erlang.
Yeah.
Many great server-side technologies. Yeah, so I'm not saying .NET doesn't do well
and
there.
And I didn't mean to say that C# owns that, but I'm saying that appropriately, that's where .NET is best.
But right I now. Would argue the most interesting client-side C# technology in the world today is Unity. Unity is swallowing up the gaming market on the bottom end.
Right? Yeah.
The Kickstarter-driven, innovative idea, even really top-tier apps that are out there that can be written in Unity. And it's not .NET per se, but it is C#
It's C# script,
really a variation of MonoDevelop. And that's really interesting. And I think one of the best opportunities, if you talk about coming disruptions, which oddly enough is the talk I did.
Yeah.
The coming disruption that's going to have the biggest impact on developers is whatever replaces the smartphone. I presume it will be some kind of augmented reality device. Mm-hmm. That finally will have a pair of glasses or a pair of goggles compelling enough that it doesn't matter how stupid you look, you want to wear them.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a huge UX problem. Massive.
Right.
And a lot of it is three-dimensional. understanding 3D camera data, and there's only so many programming languages that lend themselves to that kind of new complexity, new sophisticated libraries, and one of them that's great at it is C Sharp. Mm-hmm. I would argue right now the easiest way to program a HoloLens is in Unity, and I suspect right now we're sort of in the BlackBerry stage, so the business stage of augmented reality tech. They can work in that space and be productive. But if and when the consumer incarnation comes, the thing that actually is going to sweep smartphones off the table and be the new innovative product that everybody wants to own, that is a massive gold rush of development. And the way that Microsoft has positioned .NET with a cross-platform running on any environment, isolated from hardware at the bottom end via the CLR, largely abstracted from the UX variations with technologies like XAML and other libraries, they're very well placed to be the driving tool for augmented reality.
I don't think the smartphone's going away anytime soon, but maybe within our lifetime we will see it displaced, but I'm not so sure. I think that other devices will come and be more effective and be more compelling at certain things, but certainly something you can hold in your hand, glance down, and get information and interact with. It may not be touch screen, but I kind of think handheld devices are here for a long time. But that doesn't really matter. I think, but I was getting at the client side thing, and Blazor is this sort of peek into the future of what web development could be like in non-JavaScript languages. Doesn't mean JavaScript is certainly doesn't mean it's going away. There's no way JavaScript would ever go away. It's so much the lingua franca of the web. But now we have an opportunity to develop web applications in other languages. And I think that is, a great place for C# to live.
For sure.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for talking to me. It was a thrill listening to you. And thank you.
Well, thank you.
Good fun. Thanks.
Thanks.
Du har lyssnat på ett avsnitt av Kompilator, podcasten för dig som jobbar med utveckling. Du kan hitta tidigare sända avsnitt på kompilator.se eller genom att söka på Kompilator där du hittar dina podcasts. Kompilator produceras av Bartek Tatkowski och BRTK Digital AB. Läs mer om oss på brtk.se.